I like you, Lloyd. I always liked you. You were always the best of them. Best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine. Or Portland, Oregon, for that matter.
Welcome to The Shining 237, the podcast where we forensically examine Kubrick's horror masterpiece in 2 minute and 37 second bloody chunks. My name is Susan Tekla Kriglinska. Today we are on episode number 26, where we begin the segment with Jack saying to Lloyd, "White man's burden, Lloyd, my man," and ending with him saying, "But that bitch." So we are right in the heart of the Lloyd conversation here. My guests, I have two guests today. One is regular Shining 237 contributor, New Yorker cartoonist Joe Dader.
Hello, I'm here because the dream of the 90s is alive in Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon, for that matter.
Right, exactly. And my other guest is returning guest, Marcus Pinn. Welcome back.
Hello, hello.
Marcus is the founder and editor for Pinland Empire, which is a great underground cinema website and also one of my absolute favorite Twitter feeds. And he also does a film podcast called Zebras in America, which comes out every single week. Do check that out. I want to just mention one of my favorite things that came out over the last week was on your Twitter feed, you do these double GIFs. You'll do side by side. You'll compare two movies and put like maybe three GIFs in a row comparing three scenes that are very similar. And you did this, like one of the best ones you've done in a really long time was Clockwork Orange and Get Out. So anyway, everybody follow Pinland Empire on Twitter and of course visit the website. And I would really like to learn how to actually do that. Because every so often I do think of something I really want to put together. I recently watched Argento's Deep Red. Mm-hmm. And that really terrifying scene where the doll comes sliding into the room.
Sure.
Reminded me of in 1989, Christopher Walken's Communion, which is a movie that
towards the end when the aliens come, like kind of come into the room?
Or? No, there's this one very bizarre scene where like this sort of fake robot thing comes sliding into the room. And it's like the exact same movement and the exact same what the fuckness of it. Oh. And it's terrifying. But they're just comparatively absolutely terrifying. When I saw Communion when I was little, that just absolutely flipped me out. The movie hasn't aged that well, but it's still got some pretty amazingly scary scenes. But it just, the two of those scenes are just absolute mirrors. I don't know if they, you know, if there was an influence, but.
It's one of those things where it's like, if you have the patience and really want to do it, like it's fun. If you don't really have the patience, it's not fun at all. Because you have to kind of, you have to make the GIF, get it at a certain time, and then. Also, I don't actually, believe it or not, people find this weird. I don't have any video editing software.
Wow.
So, it has to be something that's like on Vimeo or YouTube. It's not like I rip anything from, it's whatever is online.
Right.
But luckily, a lot of stuff is on YouTube. Yeah. So that's kind of how I do my thing.
Communion is like impossible to find. Like that movie just kind of disappeared. So that wouldn't be.
Really? It used to be on, it used to be on YouTube like in 9 or 10 parts.
Because
I remember I used to watch it on YouTube. But sometimes, again, like you get lucky. Like there's even scenes, you know, you got me curious because I'm looking right now. I mean, like there's a bunch of like scenes from Communion, so you might be able to find it.
Yeah, maybe I can find it. And just let's mention two things that happened over the last week. One, Jack Nicholson turned 81. Happy birthday, Jack Nicholson.
Happy birthday.
81. And also someone who passed away was R. Lee Ermey, who played, course.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. The sergeant in Full Metal Jacket.
Sergeant Hartman.
Sergeant Hartman. And it's so funny because I had just, I swear to God, I had just written to him just within a few weeks ago, like just figured out what the best possible address was because I had been doing some Eyes Wide Shut bonus content. And, you know, he had made this bold statement that Tom Cruise was like walking all over Kubrick during that movie. So, and nobody expanded on that. So I just wrote to him and said, you know, would you be, you know, I'd be interested in hearing what else you had to say about that. But so I may have something to do with, if Scientology had their way, I may have something to do with his untimely demise.
Oh, geez, that's right. Yeah, you don't want to badmouth anybody.
I'm feeling kind of bad.
No, I have no doubt that you are solely responsible for his death.
It's horrible.
As you have been of so many people's demise.
Yes, I'm really sorry about that. Okay, so
but see,
let's...
that's the thing. I can never be mad at you. Once you say it, you giggle, you say I'm sorry, and I'm like, oh, all right, I'll let the deaths go. I'll let the murders go.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. he was. I mean, interesting guy. He did all the gun shows, so he was definitely, you know, definitely one of those guys. But everybody seemed to really love him, including Kubrick, for sure.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Matthew Modine, too, was very sad of his passing. All right, so let's begin the segment. We begin the segment with the famous lines, white man's burden, Lloyd, my man, white man's burden. And that line actually is in the King book. So Stephen King was the person who wrote that line.
Uh-huh.
Actually, Rudyard Kipling was the one who wrote that line. That's, of course...
1899 it was written.
The famous poem, White Man's Burden, the United States and Philippine Islands. That's the name of the poem. Beautifully named poem.
That's the full title.
And I
looked this up. It's kind of, I mean, to try to find some context for why Jack would say that at that moment. And he doesn't really seem to have any. I don't think
right.
the character in the film gets what he's even referencing, because it really just seems to come out of nowhere. You know, it was this poem that was sort of a love letter to imperialism, sort of intended to urge Theodore Roosevelt to go into the Philippines and basically do it the British Empire way. If you read it now, of course, just 120 years later, it's hard to read, you know? It's so utterly, utterly wrong in every way. Not only that it's the white man's job to go into these uncivilized, quote-unquote, places and teach them to be like us, but more that it's a thankless job, and it's so hard for the white men to take up this burden because we're hated for it, and oh, woe is the white man who does this God's work on earth. It's really awful.
It's really awful in the
cold light of 2018, you know.
It's pretty much as bad as it gets, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I don't know why Jack Torrance would say that to Lloyd right at that moment.
You know, it's funny because we all have different ways that we, like, view a scene. Like, that to me, it was always like, it was a combination of like a throwaway line and just his way of just like, liquor is the downfall of man, just in like a weird kind of convoluted
right.
way. And also him being an alcoholic. Like, that's how, it's weird. I never dug too deep into the original source of that, actually.
Yeah, no, it's kind of reframed because it does, you can definitely interpret it that way. Even Lloyd knows, you know, he's going off the wagon here. And in the book, he actually gives this long, long, long speech to Lloyd about going off the wagon. He literally just, there's paragraphs and paragraphs of Jack going on about the wagon in a very poetic way. It's a great bunch of dialogue in the book, actually, and worth looking up. But it is kind of reframed. But I can't help wondering if, I do believe there is a little, you know, there may be a theme of imperialism in this movie. And that was not in Stephen King's book. And I do wonder if that is true. And, you know, I'm saying it's arguable. If when, you know, as Kubrick was reading through this book, if that line didn't jump out of at him and think, oh, you know, that's an interesting theme. That could be a theme here. You know, I don't know. But
well, you've talked on the show about the Native American theme.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know,
exactly.
it's a little bit of everything. It's imperialism. It's racism. I mean, you know, I mean, the racist rhetoric gets a lot worse with Grady. You know, I mean, you know, there is a racism element to this.
But do you also think it's the emphasis on the white man's burden? And so it's sort of like he's going in there. He's, you know, in the previous segment, he was, you know, twisting himself into these pretzels of frustration as he's walking down the hallway.
And great it's all scene, by the way. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. And I love that sort of the body language that Jack is doing. He's like a little kid throwing a temper tantrum.
Yeah,
and it's
much.
All because of the old sperm bank. It's all because of his anger and frustration with his wife, who is now, because he's acting such like a little kid who's now being naughty and taking a drink, he's turning his wife into his mother at this point. And
yeah.
he's sort of, it's,
oh, damn.
It sort of becomes this thing about he's, I think his emphasis is on not so much the white, but the man, white man's burden. He's a man, and this is his burden to deal with these crazy women. You can't live with them, you know.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. The, I, you know, I think there's a little bit of all of that in there. Okay, so Say, Lloyd, seems I'm temporarily light. How's my credit in this joint? So he had been just bragging about having all this money in his pocket to burn. Your credit's fine here, Mr. Torrance. That's swell. I like you, Lloyd. I always liked you. You are always the best of them. Best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine, Portland, Oregon, for that matter.
Can I say this is the only time Jack says swell in this movie? But it's only 2 years after Lois Lane gave Clark Kent shit about saying it in Superman the movie.
Good observation.
I like that word, so I keep track of swell. Can I ask you, what do you think of this way that Jack is talking to Lloyd? Because he says, I like you, Lloyd. And then he switches to past tense. I always liked you. You were always the best of them. Because it's almost like you can't tell if he's there or not, or if this is a dream or not. So he's talking to Lloyd like he's in the present and the past. What do you think of that?
Well, I know, especially at my job and the kind of rhetoric and talk that goes around, like, that's something that people say to me all the time. It's just like, I always like you, no matter what they said. It's like, literally, I always like you, present, no matter what they've said about you, and it's like past. So that's just...
But so, and that doesn't make you think that maybe you're an apparition who's not really there?
No, well, not until now, obviously.
That would send a red flag up for me. I would think, hey, yeah, wait right? a minute, what if I'm yeah. dead?
Yeah, right. But I think when you bring it up, that particular present and past tense, and is this even going on, is just kind of the epitome of his presence in the Overlook Hotel to begin with. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not going to act like, when you mention it, it's like, oh, damn, that's pretty awesome.
Of course, the Jack in the photograph ending for this movie is Kubrick, you know, came up with that. And, you know, again, it could be inspired from just this point where we go from Jack seeing an apparition and acting like he already knew this guy. Hey, it's Lloyd. To shifting gears and even talking about having known him for a really long time. And it just sort of, it's all gelling this concept, you know, and you could see Kubrick going, oh, that's clever. And then running with it, you know?
Yeah.
What's your take on Lloyd, Marcus? Is he in the realm of movie characters and all that stuff?
He's an interesting guy. I mean, obviously I don't want to be like, so blunt and obvious about it. He's obviously some, you know, spirit ghost, not really there. But there's like, I think everything inside, everything is haunted. Everything is, quote, bad, evil, whatever. But there's kind of a calming to, you know, to him. There's also a hint of, I don't want to say patronizing, but just kind of saying what he wants to hear. Sometimes like, sure, of course, Mr. Torrance. Right, of course. Yeah. Like, so again, not patronizing, but there's something, and I think that goes back to the calming, because it reminds me, or just about anyone, when you're really upset, just like he was, just coming down from when you're around someone, to calm you down, they just like kind of agree with you. Like, of course, yeah, totally. I know, sure. Totally. But you have to calm down. Like, kind of, you know, so that's kind of what I take from that.
It's true. He's interesting character. He's great at that, because later on he says, women can't live with him, can't live without him. Yeah. And Jack responds to that and says, words of wisdom, Lloyd.
Yeah.
Which they aren't. They're not. They're
just, exactly. Yeah.
It's the most banal statement possible. But Lloyd is really good at reading the room.
Well, he's the perfect bartender, but he's also the perfect ghost that wants to ultimately, as part of the package of Overlook Ghosts, manipulate Jack, you know, and play with him, you know,
one of those enabling ghosts.
Yeah, he's an enabling ghost. And Jack he's kind of making a little bit of a fool of himself here. You know, he's just sort of being such a hammy jokester. You know, he's that guy, and you know, just like it fits perfectly with the setting. He's the guy at the bar who's getting drunk, who's, you know, his voice is louder than everybody else in the room. Even if you pictured a whole other room full of people, you know, Jack's voice would be above them all.
Yep.
And he thinks he's witty.
Yeah.
He thinks he's clever.
And Lloyd's just like, yep, you're hysterical, sir.
Totally. Exactly.
He's quoting Kipling without any understanding of what he's saying.
Yep.
Like he thinks he knows what it means.
So Lloyd says, thank you for saying so. And Jack says, here's... So this is interesting. Jack says, here's to 5 miserable months on the wagon and all the irreparable harm that it's caused me. Now, earlier in this movie, we had Wendy talking to a doctor, and she claimed that when Jack had injured Danny's arm, he hadn't had a drink since. And here we have Jack telling the bartender it's been 5 months. Now, how long have they been in the hotel at this point? A fair amount of time. Despite all the title cards telling me how long we've been there, I've lost track at this point. But we've certainly been in the hotel for a couple months, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's. I laughed when I saw that because I had forgotten that he said 5 miserable months because that's not a long time at all.
No, it's not a long time.
It's a really short time.
And also, if that's really when he stopped drinking, I mean, he just took this job right after getting sober and just was like, yeah, yeah, I'll lock myself in a hotel for the winter.
Yep. So that's why I like doing this podcast. There's stuff that I didn't even think about. Like, this is also... Because, and this, not I'm not trying to divert too much, but this is definitely a movie that I watched a lot as a kid. And then even at, like, so it just kind of became ingrained. And then the older I got, like, early apartment, like, when I had my early apartments in New York City, it's definitely a movie that I would just kind of have on. So sometimes you just have stuff on and you kind of forget, and it all just kind of melds into this one weird, like, memory. And then, yeah, like... You can always quote. I mean, obviously, here's Johnny, but then, like, the little like, you've watched it so much. It's, yeah, like the equivalent of, like, when you have to work on something and you're staying up late to get it done and you're working on it for so long that you start to get, you know, blurry-eyed, and then you start to make these mistakes, and then, like, it all just turns into this, like, mess kind of thing. And that's, so that's, like, that's what I'm learning as I'm doing this particular episode right now.
I heard on your previous appearance on the show, you said that you had first seen it when you were 7 years old. Is that true?
Did I say, yeah, I mean, it would have been around that time. Yeah, 6 or 7, definitely, because I actually live in the house that I was kind of born in, so I remember watching it here. It was before we moved to Massachusetts, so yeah, it would have had to have been 6 or 7, absolutely. But
were you scared, or were just too young to even understand what was going on?
A little startled, but just more intrigued. Like the intrigue of this weird movie that I didn't even fully understand kept, like, just trumped everything.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it was that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the weird thing about this movie is it's sort of, it's such a work of art. It's such a work of art that almost supersedes the scariness of it.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
And yeah, there's no super scary monsters except for the old lady is pretty scary. You know, she's pretty, I would think as a 6-year-old, that would be a little like, whoa.
See, but that didn't even really, it was just more like, what's happening? Because the editing, it was more
of
like.
Course it was blurred out. Yeah.
Oh, no, this was my dad, whatever, he's passed away now, so you can't do anything with it. But my dad was the king of, this was in the 80s and in the 90s, my dad was the king of the, he had dual VHS, so whenever we'd rent movies, he'd have the blank tapes, and he would just copy whatever we rented. So I was gonna say, I think, I was trying to remember if this was, like, a taped off TV version, but no, this was straight from, like, the video store rental.
Wow.
So I saw everything. Yeah. It was more the editing of that scene, where it's like, oh, it's this pretty woman, and then she's laughing, and then it cuts to Danny, and he's, like, foaming at the mouth, and he shake. It's more like, what's happening? Not like, oh, this is scary. Yeah. It's like, wait, what? I just think of the mannerism of, like, leaning forward, like, wait, what? And you just, like, want more, like, you want to investigate versus, like, oh, this is scary, get me out of here. It's more like, yeah, no, I need, what the hell is going on?
So, but as a child, did you have other experience with scary films? Did you always have a sort of feel sort of inured to them?
Yes, I did. It was more stuff like scary movies, and my mom would attest to this, and if my dad were here, he would attest to this too. It was like scary movies, and it was more like which they learned quick, going to, like, see an Easter Bunny, or if we were in a mall and a clown was there. Like, I didn't like that, like, big, like, Muppets.
Yes.
Like Sesame Street stuff, taking me to see appearances of, like, Big Bird, like, that stuff scared me. But, like, I remember watching, like, being, you know, 5 or 6 and seeing, like, Freddy Krueger, and it was like, oh, this guy's funny. You know what I mean? And he was. Right. It was his humor that, like, kind of eased the horror of it. You know what I mean? So, I don't know.
That's so funny.
Mascots, I think, are the next clowns, and that they're going to
be
persona non grata in the next few decades.
Yep. You
know, we're going to see a big move towards mascots being scary rather than delightful. Horror writers, take that up.
You know what scared me so much as a little kid? Elves. Elves scared me. Like, little tiny people. You have no control over little tiny people. I don't know. There was something about elves. They freaked me out.
But, like, if you go to, like, a Santa at the mall, there'd always be, like, a person, an assistant dressed as an elf. Would that?
No. If he was large, I was fine. It was the actual idea of a human being the size of, like, your hand. That terrified me. Like, and I would have, like, little hallucinations of seeing things move and thinking it was an elf. But the movie that freaked me out when I was a little kid and accidentally turned to, like, public television and they were showing Nosferatu, and that face, you know, that look of that monster It took me like a year to like be able to, you know, sleep through the night.
The original one or the
Herzog? The original. Oh, okay. Yeah. So for me, I did have some scary monsters, you know, that I'll always remember. But anyway, it's interesting because I think I'm sure the shower lady would have freaked me out quite a bit. But yeah, there's not, you know, besides, and the little girl's being axed, there's nothing that's like, you know.
Damn, that's crazy. It's like, what was wrong with me? Even that was more like, I think just the edit. I mean, whatever. When you're a really little kid, you're not used to seeing jump cuts and editing techniques. True. So that was probably the first, like at that age, true, the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. So it was just like, whoa. But yes. I do have to say in that TV remake, the miniseries, which, you know, whatever, it wasn't very good. The shower lady in that version was pretty creepy.
I agree.
And
with
I was
that.
Much and I was much older.
Sure.
Two great things in the
I was a teenager.
I always bash the miniseries, but two great
of
things.
Of course.
Pat Hingle as Watson was fantastic. He was dead on and he captured the character from the book. He's the only one who like nailed his role. And the old lady in the tub, they blew their entire budget on her, and that was definitely, they got what they should have gotten. She was perfect. She was really genuinely scary. They did get her. I agree with that. All right, so we're coming up. The lady's coming soon, by the way. She's coming.
Nice.
I want to bring up something in this minute, in this segment that really always stands out for me is when Jack says to Lloyd, best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon, for that matter. It's it always stands out because I love that he says Portland, Maine first, because that is generally known as the lesser Portland. But it's the first one that he mentions. Then again, back in those days, you know, Portland, Oregon wasn't quite as much of a cultural center as it is now.
True.
So it might not have been. It was, or everything out in Oregon was considered the wilderness back then. The whole Northwest was
true.
It was not hip yet. It was before Starbucks. It was before grunge. But I just wanted to know, like, how big of a compliment is he giving Lloyd? So I looked it up. From Timbuktu to Portland, Maine, it's approximately 4,292 miles.
Nice.
That's pretty impressive. Wow. And I looked up, I went on Google Maps to see, like, the way to get there. And it literally says you can't. I looked for transit directions, and it said there are none. Driving directions said, sorry, we could not calculate driving directions from Timbuktu, Mali to Portland, Maine. Walking directions, no dice. Absolutely
of
not.
Of course.
No, yeah. No way. Anyway, then I put in Portland, Oregon, which is from Timbuktu to Portland, Oregon is 6,715 miles.
Jeez.
So that's a pretty good upgrade he gives him there. When he adds Portland, Oregon, that's a 2,500-mile extra compliment he's giving him.
And wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's, and you can see Lloyd is that good.
He's that good, right.
He is that good.
He's like, no, Portland, Maine, that's not good enough. You go all the way from Timbuktu to Portland, Oregon.
Certainly Joe Turkell is that good. So,
can we talk about Joe Turkell? Because I haven't gotten the chance.
You know, I did talk about him a lot in the last episode. I talked about a lot of the, you know, the sort of the anecdotes around him and Jack. But yeah, let's talk about Joe.
Well, I was just looking up his IMDb page, and he has 142 actor credits, and yet there many of them are few and far between. And his last role was on a television part on Boy Meets World in 1998. I can't even imagine what he would have looked like showing up on Boy Meets World. He did Fantasy Island. He did Miami Vice. He did a Kojak where he played a character called Swamp Gas. That makes me very happy. I need to look up that episode. Oh, he was on The Chicago Teddy Bears, which was a sitcom about 1920s gangsters from the early 70s.
Wow.
He was on Adam 12. Land of the Giants, that was the Irwin Allen show, Ironside. But I've seen this film and I don't remember him in it, but he's in the movie Which Way Is Up, which is the Richard Pryor film.
Oh, is he?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
Yeah,
oh, where he takes the kids like on a school bus trip and then stuff happens.
Which Way Is Up is the one where...
No, that's not... No,
Pryor
no.
He plays three different roles in that one.
Yeah, I'm thinking of... Yeah, it's the car movie. Right, I'm thinking of the other... I'm thinking of another movie. I do want to add on to you, though, the great thing about Joel Turkell and just The Shining in general is that it's one of those things that dispels something, because another big thing about Turkell and The Shining in general is that this was the third or fourth movie that he'd done with Stanley Kubrick.
Third, yeah.
Just like the actor who plays Grady, also in The Clockwork Orange, and I think he's in something else also. But he kind of, you know, Stanley Kubrick, when you're a filmmaker like him, and it's similar kind of like to Terrence Malick, but to a lesser extent, where like there's always these myths that get built up about directors. And I remember all through high school, well, junior high and high school, when the internet was there, but not what it is today, you could still easily just make shit up. And I remember people being like, you know, oh, Stanley Kubrick, he never works with the same actors twice. He's one of the few directors that doesn't have his regular group of... Because, you know, I'd say about 80% of directors have their regulars. They'll stray occasionally, but then those actors that they stray with eventually become part of their troupe. And this is just another example that kind of dispels... I mean, we all know there's a million Kubrick myths and rumors that are just literally not true.
Off the top of my head, Sterling Hayden.
Right. Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers. Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
Right.
Timothy Carey.
Timothy Carey.
Yeah. Exactly. So just, you know, it's another one of those things. Yes. I didn't know we were going to get into it. Well, I guess it would make sense that we would get into the actor, but I'm really glad you brought him up.
And by the way, just a little for next week, believe it or not, Peter Sellers, there is a little tiny weird tangential minute connection to this movie, and you won't believe it when I reveal it. So
other than Peter Sellers dying the same year this movie came out.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, well, maybe it's a tribute to him.
But when was this released? What 80. Part of the year? Yeah, but when?
Oh, why am I forgetting? I think it was May or something.
Okay, Peter Sellers died in August.
Okay.
I remember that because I was devastated as a 13.
Yes, yeah. I know. Oh, and that's another thing. So this Friday, I'm taping a special bonus episode for Patreons on Dr. Strangelove. And Mr. Joe Dader will be one of the guests. And we're going to have a roundtable. And it's going to be fantastic. So everybody go to my Patreon page, check it out. And if you're interested in bonus content like that, it's a lot of fun. So, and Joe is a Peter Sellers fanatic. So it's going to be really fun. So at this point, Lloyd says, so how are things going, Mr. Torrance? Which is an interesting question because, you know, the management is checking in on, you know, Jack, trying to evaluate him, I guess. Jack says, things could be better, Lloyd. Things could be a whole lot better. And he said, I hope it's nothing serious. No, nothing serious. Just a little problem. Oh, wait, have we had him drink yet? Because I'm now...
Here's to 5 miserable months on the wagon.
Is that... So, yeah, we forgot to talk about when he takes that sip and his eyes just glaze over. And there's a really dramatic pause that I think we're supposed to be absorbing the alcohol with Jack. You know, I think it's very actually dramatic that Kubrick kind of makes everything stop for a minute. And we watch Jack just take in that alcohol.
Yeah.
He sort of does the Kubrick face a little bit, only he rolls his eyes up without, like, tilting his head down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really very very dramatic and almost unexpected. Okay, so I hope it's nothing serious, Lloyd says. And he says, no, nothing serious. Just a little problem with the old sperm bank upstairs. Now, this stuff is not in the book. Nothing I can't handle, though, Lloyd. Thanks. And then Lloyd says, women can't live with him, can't live without him. Words of wisdom, Lloyd, words of wisdom. And he does the eyebrows. Now, this is at least the second time he's done the eyebrows. He did the eyebrows with Danny when Danny was on his lap in that really super creepy father-son moment.
He will.
We will see more eyebrows going up and down before the movie's over. I really don't like that.
He doesn't just arch them. He does like a full-on Groucho wiggle.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a bit much. I think now we're just now at this point crossing into the territory where I think Jack Nicholson is officially overacting to the point where it's a little bit distracting from the movie. And I know that's debatable. You know, some people just love every minute of his performance. I think it takes you a little bit out of the movie. And of course, if you go to this and see this in a theater, you will, you know, around this point, certainly start seeing people laughing at the performance, you know.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, too, that's another thing going back to when I, you know, sometime between junior high and early high school, that's when I discovered Kubrick. And even still to this day, he's one of those directors where you can't criticize anything he's done. You have to like everything associated with everything he's done. And, you know, I remember when you're younger, it's just, oh, it's Jack Nicholson. He is a great actor. He's an icon. But then when I started to, you know, investigate and all the stuff about how Stephen King and wasn't happy with this version, blah, blah, blah. I do sometimes think it's like, oh, maybe a John Voight or someone like that, it actually would have been cool. Only a John Voight, but within the same, the entirely same movie, same director, same ambiance, atmosphere, everything, just a different actor, because the whole idea, it's like, it's this normal straight-laced kind of guy, and as the movie goes on, as the movie progresses, his insanity progresses, and it's like, you just, when you associate Jack Nicholson, you already think of, like, the mischievous stuff, the eyebrows, the, it's easy to go crazy, so it,
the
it's,
laugh,
it,
yeah.
The laugh, so it does kind of like, you know, it's like, I think, because when you take Kubrick, Jack Nicholson combo, you're, you know, anyone's scared to criticize that, but the older I got, it's like, eh, I mean, this movie is legendary, it's a classic, but it would have been interesting to see a more straightforward Robert Redford, John Voight kind of guy play the role of Jack Torrance.
Definitely. And, yeah, and you know,
I said Bruce Dern, I thought, could have done this part too.
See, ooh, that, obviously I would see that, but that almost goes into the, like, Jack Nicholson realm, and, like, he was kind of known for, he'd be a villain, or he's this, no, like, he, even when he was older, he was kind of hulking to some degree, like, he's on the taller side, that still would have been very interesting. Oh, I'm thinking about it right now, you know what I mean, but I didn't even think about that. Wow.
I think Warner execs, you know, Stanley always wanted Jack, period, that was it, but yeah. Warner execs did suggest, I think, Robin Williams too, which is an interesting idea.
Oh, no,
and that would have been, I think, his first serious role at that point. Mm-hmm.
Well, with all due, you know, with all due respect, may he rest in peace, he's all, but I don't know if that would have,
yeah,
I don't know about that.
That might, well, it would have been similar, you know, similar situation, because he's a comedian.
Exactly.
He's a comedian.
Exactly.
Now we should.
A few great villains later in his career. I think he would have been too young at the time.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's it. I agree.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 1 hour photo and a couple other things I can't really think of right now.
The insomnia.
Insomnia, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But also, people who were in the editing room do say that Jack Nicholson did much more subtle takes. You know, they, of course, obviously they did 6,200 often, and there were much, much, much more what other people thought were on the nose performances. And they said Kubrick always went for the absolute over the top. So we can't really, you know, put the blame completely on Nicholson, of course, because he, you know, it's really what it was. It's all on, you know, it's all what Stanley wanted.
Yeah, there's that legendary behind-the-scenes footage, and the thing that always struck me about that was the moment where he's doing it, where Kubrick's doing a take with Nicholson, and he says to Nicholson, "Yeah, it's real, but it's not interesting," and he makes him do it again because he's apparently, you know, it seemed like Nicholson was playing it believable, but Kubrick wanted more. He wanted exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, again, we've talked in the past, like, silent film acting, Lon Chaney-like acting, or Buster Keaton-like acting. You know, and Jack Nicholson kind of has that look. You can almost picture him in a silent movie. He has this, you know, very expressive face, and, you know, you can sort of, you know, and even when we see him with the Joker makeup, even more picture him having that makeup on and being in a silent film and being just, like, over the top and being brilliant at it, you know?
Yeah.
And Tim Burton was so influenced by German expressionism for that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it all kind of flows.
Yeah, we're back to Nosferatu.
Okay, so he says, so again, this is the point where I think it gets a little out of hand, and Jack says, I laid a hand on him. God damn it, I didn't. I wouldn't touch him. I wouldn't touch one hair on his goddamn little head. I love the little son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I'd do anything for him. Any fucking thing. It's just so great. It is really fun, the contrast between him attempting to express love for his child and, like, using all of this cursing and all this anger. And, you know, it's pretty funny, but it's definitely over the top.
This is how a lot of fathers of his generation sounded, though, when they talked about their kids. It's not atypical.
I'd agree with that.
I guess you're right, you know. So, Marcus, the last time you were on, we were doing the Holleran Danny scene in the kitchen, that great long conversation, one of my absolute favorite scenes. So actually coming up next week, I probably should have switched you to next week. But I mean, on the other hand, you don't want to do two Hollerans. But so Holleran's actually going to pop up at the end of the next scene coming up. So he's coming back. Aside from Holleran and Danny, like, what scenes, like, really stand out for you? What's your favorite?
Well, at this point, I want to go to the kind of scene that we were dissecting, you know, for the majority of the show. Like, this is, like, a big turning point, you know? He's drinking again, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, like, things like we're in the deep of it now. Like he's been accused of, you know, hurting his son, you know, at this point, and he's slowly losing it, and now he's really losing it, and then the whole supernatural stuff is full on. Yeah, I think not just this segment, but this whole scene is really crucial. I mean, I don't want to jump ahead because we haven't actually gone to, like, my favorite scene in the movie.
I don't mind at all. I don't mind at all.
Well, I guess, I mean, the bathroom scene is my favorite.
Is it?
Scene in this movie. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very cold, weird, creepy scene. And just how, like, you know, Grady's tone and everything, it just slowly, like, whoa, wait. How did we get here? Because he was just like, oh, I'm so sorry, I spilled. Oh, I'm sorry, we'll get you cleaned up. Oh, I'm so sorry. And then suddenly it's just like, you've always been here. Like, just it's this weird, seamless chant. Like, oh, you're an evil dude now. All of a sudden, wait, when did this? Like, you almost want to, like, go back a few seconds. Like, did I miss something? That was such a weird.
Right.
It's like a sudden yet seamless transition to, like, he's a totally different person. Even his face. Like, you know, his face is more open when he, you know, at first. And then when you get deep into the conversation, he squints his eyes a little more. There's more of a frown on his face. His eyebrows are lowered and he's just standing still for the most part. It's a really, really great scene.
That's actually my favorite scene. That's my absolute favorite scene, too.
Nice.
Yeah. So, it's like the flow of it, of course, the slowness of it. And yet, you know, the space between both physically what you're seeing between the two guys and between their words.
Yeah.
There's no other scene like it, like in any movie that I can think of. You know, I just, as intense, the intensity of it, it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Joe?
Well, I want to mention the jacket.
Ah, yes.
I want to mention that the jacket, which has not been talked about yet, which is that Jack rolls up to the bar in this scene wearing his corduroy windbreaker, and he's greeted by Lloyd, who's wearing like a velour tuxedo jacket. Both jackets are the same color.
Yes, that's
true.
Maroon.
They're both wearing maroon.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which is further sort of, I guess, evidence that Lloyd is a manifestation of Jack's mind, possibly.
Yeah.
I don't know, or it could be a coincidence, or just like Lloyd is just a snappy dresser, clearly. but I do want to mention the jacket only because it just recently sold at auction, or one of the jackets recently sold at auction, and it was from the collection of Emilio D'Alessandro, who was sort of Kubrick's right-hand man, or
he was officially his driver,
but he did everything
for
him, and he worked for him for like 20 years. And there's a documentary right now on Netflix called S is for Stanley, and it's about Emilio D'Alessandro.
Yeah, it played at the New York Film Festival last year. I didn't see it there, but I did manage to see it. Yeah, it's a guy I didn't even really know about.
Yeah, I will devote one episode where we'll talk a lot about that, because he needs to be talked about. You're right. And
just briefly, Emilio D'Alessandro amassed an enormous collection of Kubrick's things, memorabilia covering all of his films, all the way up to Eyes Wide Shut, and he had worked for Kubrick, so, and Kubrick loved this man, but so he recently auctioned off all of his Kubrick memorabilia, and he had a huge amount of stuff, and you can see it in the documentary, and there's a point where he's towards the end of it where he's got all of these iconic articles of clothing hanging on hooks, and there's Nicholson's maroon corduroy windbreaker right there on a hook, and I'm just like, I want to reach through my TV and grab it. My God, I want to just put it on. So anyway, they recently had an auction in Italy where he sold off all of his Kubrick memorabilia, and the jacket sold for, it's one of the jackets, but there were multiple ones made. So it sold for 19,000 euro, which is about $23,000. Seems kind of low, surprising.
Yeah, in the scheme of multi-bazillionaires out there, you would think it would have actually sold for a little more. Well, congratulations, rich person.
Person who won that auction, whoever they are out there. And I hope they got the right axe to go with the jacket.
Yes. I think there were a lot.
Murdering your family.
There's a lot of axes. It should have been pretty easy for him to pick up an axe for a little extra.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the prop axes, too. Those are out there. Probably even cheaper.
There's rubber prop axes all over the place, lined up on the floor. All right. Well, so we end with him saying that bitch, and we have a very colorful speech coming up for next week. So Thank you guys once again.
Of course, anytime.
For hanging out with me.
Thank you, but how's my credit in this joint anyway?
Your credit's always good here, sir. Thanks to Marcus Pinn for being back on the show, and please check out Pinland Empire, the website. Check him out on Twitter, and also, of course, his podcast, Zebras in America. And thanks also to Joe Dader, New Yorker cartoonist. Joe actually used to do a podcast called Songs You're Sick Of, which was about pop music mostly from the 70s. And I was on occasionally, and he had a lot of great guests. And if you can look for that on iTunes, that's out there. If you need an extra dose of Joe Dader. Right now, if you're listening in real time, as just after I published this, it's April 2018. Last chance to sign up for my Patreon to get the sticker that has the twins on it, which is either going to say accident prone, or dying to play. I haven't quite decided yet. We'll be posting right under the wire a Doctor Strangelove roundtable. Every month I'll be posting extra content, including roundtables on Kubrick's other movies, and if there's a new sticker every month. So please do check out patreon.com/theshining237 or go to my regular website, theshining237.com, and I have a link from there. And also, of course, join us on Facebook and Twitter at theshining237, and please do subscribe on iTunes. Tune in next week for episode number 27, where we have such great lines as a momentary loss of muscular coordination, and Wendy coming in and saying, there's someone in the hotel with us. There's a crazy woman in one of the rooms. And Jack saying, are you out of your fucking mind? Whatever else I do.